This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Vincent McCorry, and here's what's coming up.
They want the whole process redone. They consider the elections illegal. They don't feel the elections were free and fair, and they feel there was a lot of irregularities.
That's VOA Abdushakur Aboud talking about opposition concerns over extended voting in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Also, concerns grow about massive displacement of civilians in Sudan's conflict, and a look at U.S. efforts to boost trade and investment with African nations. All this and much more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The Democratic Republic of Congo entered a second day of voting today. The Election Commission, known as CENI, extended voting after a chaotic rollout and lengthy delays yesterday meant many could not vote despite standing in line for hours. President Félix Tshisekedi is seeking a second and final five-year term. There are 18 other candidates, but his top challengers are his 2018 electoral rival Martin Fayulu, businessman Moise Katumbi, and Nobel laureate Denis Mukwege. My Swahili service colleague Abdul Shakur Aboud is in Kinshasa, and a short time ago he updated editor Kate Pound-Dawson on the election.
Everything looks like it's going on smoothly today, although in Kinshasa you don't have a lot of stations which are doing the voting again, but mostly it's in the east where we are told a lot of people did not participate in the voting. So as far as we understand, it's all going on well, and it hopes to be finished today. While that is going on, counting has finished in some places. We visited some places here in Kinshasa. Some vote polling stations have finished counting, and they've even announced some of the winners. But that is really, really very less than a 1%, we can say.
I understand there is some controversy about extending the voting, that some opposition party members are unhappy about it. What's going on with that?
Yes, the opposition are totally angry, not only about the extension of the voting. The extension of the voting is illegal according to the Constitution. But five of the candidates, presidential candidate, together with Martin Fayulu, who was beaten by Tshisekedi in 2018, together with Moise Katumbi and Mukwege, Dr. Mukwege, and another popular person, Theodore, have issued a statement shortly saying that they want the whole process redone. They consider the elections illegal. They don't feel the elections were free and fair, and they feel there was a lot of irregularities. So they have issued a statement not recognizing the elections before even the results are out.
Is there any announcement as to when we might get results? Have those been postponed? Is there any definite indication as to when we'll get all the final numbers?
No, we don't know. We have no idea. CENI themselves, they don't know. We tried to tell them. About 2 hours ago, they issued a statement saying that they agreed, the president of CENI, Kadima, saying that they agree there has been a lot of problems, but they think everything is going well. But hoping that by tomorrow they will be having all results counted from all areas where people are participating today, and they expect in the next 48 hours they might have partial results.
Well, that was Abdul Shakur Aboud with the VOA Swahili service, who was speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. In Sudan, where conflict between two competing military factions has gone for more than 8 months, aid groups say more than 6 million people are on the brink of famine. Over a three-day period, recently more than 300,000 people fled an area in Al Jazeera state that before had seemed relatively safe. Mathilde Vu, advocacy director in Sudan for the Norwegian Refugee Council, tells VOA's Caravan Dam that people don't realize how significant those numbers are, and that she is aware of reports saying some refugees who returned to Sudan are being forced to fight by both the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Army.
Sudan was already one of the largest displacement crises in the world. We had more than 6.2 million people displaced over this past 8 months. 1 million of them crossed the borders into the neighboring countries. But now, just in 3 days, 300,000 people are now forced to flee. And the tragedy of this is that most of them had to do this twice in the past 8 months. They had to do it twice because 8 months ago, they were living in Khartoum, in the capital city, and they thought they were okay. And on the 15th of April, a sort of urban warfare completely destroyed the city, completely destroyed the capital. And you had basically more than 30% of the inhabitants of Khartoum, they've left. And they found refuge 160 kilometers away in Wad Madani. Many of them couldn't go further away because they just simply had no means to go further. They couldn't pay for transportation. They had nowhere to go. And so they were stuck in Wad Madani. And now over this past 3 days, fighting basically was at the door of the city and then entered it. And that's how we see now continuous flow of families, completely desperate, completely traumatized and tired to have gone through this again and again.
The NRC is there on the ground in a lot of these neighboring areas where the refugee camps are set up. Can you share some like personal stories of some of these families where you've seen these people come across a border?
Yes. So, I mean, the tragedy of Sudan, again, is that it's, first of all, Sudan was a country of asylum. You know, it was hosting one of the largest population of refugees of the continent. Eritrean, Ethiopian, South Sudanese refugees had found refuge in Sudan. Starts the war, this basically country of asylum becomes a war zone. And you have basically a mix of foreign nationals and Sudanese people running for their life and basically trying to find a shelter and safety across the border. So they fled, 1.1 million people fled to Chad, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and Egypt, mostly. And all those neighboring countries, where most of them we work in those countries, and we know that those countries are extremely fragile. We know that those countries have also their own conflict to deal with. They are also struggling with economic downturn, with a lot of humanitarian crisis on their own, and have zero capacity to actually welcome and host properly people who are fleeing the war in Sudan. So, for example, in Chad, you have a caseload of refugees who've been here for 20 years because 20 years ago they fled the genocide in Darfur. And now they are seeing hundreds of thousands of people coming, crossing from the same border through the same roads that, you know, 20 years ago they fled because, again, Darfur is on fire and mass atrocities are being committed. It's the same for South Sudan, where South Sudan has seen a lot of conflict over these past years. A lot of refugees from South Sudan crossed into Sudan to find safety, some of them reaching Khartoum. And now those same people have to return back to South Sudan in places that, you know, they don't feel safe either. So I don't think there's many wars in the world where people are fleeing a war zone to end up in another very unstable and very fragile country.
And then we've heard reports on top of all that, with this kind of miserable conditions you're talking about, that the people find in these refugee camps, there's not enough food. There's people with weapons inside the refugee camps, and there's violence there. So some of them have actually turned back to Sudan, and then they get forcibly recruited by both sides, either be it the RSF or the Sudan Army. Have you heard anything about that?
We've seen those reports, and they are extremely, extremely concerning. And, you know, what these reports show is how complex the situation of Sudan is, and how also it's not only about Sudan, it's also about the region. And that if we continue to turn a blind eye on what's going on in Sudan, on the refugee crisis across the borders, then we're going to see this type of dynamics. And the people who are going to suffer the most are going to be the civilians, who basically will have nowhere to flee, nowhere safe to be, and will have to, perhaps to resort to very harmful coping mechanisms because they have no other choices.
That was Mathilde Vu, Advocacy Director in Sudan for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. Israeli President Isaac Herzog has vowed to change the course of history by destroying the Hamas militants in Gaza Strip and then sort out peace between Israelis and Palestinians at a later date. He added that Israel would only allow reconstruction of the territory after it has control of Gaza. Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, discussed these statements with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
Before I comment on the statement, I think it's important to note that the president in Israel has a ceremonial role. You know, the prime minister is the real leader. But having said that, Herzog is an important figure, and he's important mainly in the sense that he reflects and also strengthens the sense of consensus among the public in Israel. And I have to say, having just returned from a visit in Jerusalem, I think he does reflect the consensus in what he said. However, there are some cracks in this consensus, and I think that what he was trying to do was to bolster the consensus. In other words, the consensus is that Israel must defeat Hamas. Now, what defeating means is a different story, and we can talk about it if you'd like. In that sense, he did reflect Israeli policy, and he reflected the consensus in Israel around this policy. Whether this goal that he tried to characterize is attainable is, and at what price, that's a question. And my own opinion increasingly is that it is not.
When asked about the feasibility of a two-state solution in which an independent Israel and Palestine both exist, Mr. Herzog suggested that there was no trust between Israelis and Palestinians at present, saying nobody believes it is feasible. What would the Biden administration do to adhere to its commitment to a two-state solution with such an Israeli position?
Well, again, I think that he's also correct about the fact that there isn't trust on either side. If you judge by the attitudes on the street in Israel and among Palestinians, both in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, he is definitely correct. But that's where leadership comes in. Leaders, particularly if they do believe in a two-state solution, and I know that Herzog does believe in it, should chart the way and attempt to influence and shape public opinion so that public attitudes would be supportive of those goals. We don't see this happening on either side. Now, granted, there's a war going on, and during a war, perhaps it's not something that one should, you know, expect. However, we are dealing with an Israeli government that clearly does not want a two-state solution and does almost everything it can to prevent a two-state solution. Now, I asked about what Biden can do. It really depends on how sincere Biden is in his support for a two-state solution and how active he wants to be in advancing it. He has leverages, particularly in the context of this war that's ongoing, and he can use these leverages in order to maybe not bring both sides to the negotiating table sometime soon, but at the very least, to prevent the Israeli government from blocking the way to a two-state solution. And, you know, we're demanding that the Israeli government stop settlements and things like that sort. So the question is whether he's going to use those leverages. We've seen during this war how dependent Israel is on U.S. support. And I hope very much that President Biden will use the leverages he has.
Mr. Herzog's comments come as Israel faces increased scrutiny from the international community regarding its apparent disregard for civilian life in Gaza. When pressed on the cost to civilian life in Israeli's operation, Mr. Herzog said responsibility for the death rested on Hamas. How would that argument convince the international community?
Although there is definitely a great deal of responsibility that Hamas bears on the events that unfolded following October 7th, saying that Hamas is the only one that's responsible for the death toll in Gaza is propaganda. And I think that what Herzog was saying was, in fact, Israeli propaganda. Israel is a sovereign government, and the IDF is an army that aspires to be moral and aspires to act according to international law, has a great deal of responsibility to try to minimize as much as possible the death toll among civilians in the Gaza Strip. And unfortunately, we see an attitude in Israel that does not jibe with that. Israel trying to minimize the death toll among civilians in Gaza is an Israeli interest. Israel needs international support, and this support is eroding very much because of what is perceived internationally as a disregard for civilian life. So I'm very, very disturbed that Herzog said that. I really, really hope that this attitude, which I have now seen having visited Israel, that this attitude will change and that Israel will be much more careful about the death toll it inflicts in the Gaza Strip among civilians.
That was Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Vincent McCorry in Washington. For more information on this and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Separatist Tuareg forces have announced a blockade on the major roads in northern Mali, where the army has made inroads in recent weeks. The Permanent Strategic Framework, CSP, an alliance of rebel forces, said it decided to set up roadblocks across all roads leading to borders with Mauritania, Algeria, and Niger. The mainly Tuareg rebel forces have in recent weeks lost ground to a Malian army offensive that in mid-November led to the recapture of the northeast city of Kidal. It's been a year since African leaders assembled in Washington, D.C. for the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit that focused on developing economic and strategic partnerships. It called for significantly enhancing two-way trade and investment collaborations, boosting Africa's position in the global economy, promoting innovation and entrepreneurship, and making advancements in critical sectors. To review the progress achieved since the summit, VOA's Paul Ndiho interviewed Michael Jordan, Prosper Africa's chief of staff, via Skype. They discussed the significant strides made by the United States in trade and investment.
Prosper Africa exists to boost two-way trade and investment. We help U.S. companies get into Africa. We help African countries, companies to grow and connect with U.S. companies. We're the connective tissue. We want to build a strong conduit between the two geographies so that for mutual benefit.
It's been a year since the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. Bring us up to speed. What has Prosper Africa been up to?
Well, Prosper Africa was created to increase two-way trade and investment between the United States and the entire African continent. We've made tremendous progress on boosting trade, on boosting investment, on incentivizing the private sector, and on mobilizing finance for African business. I can cite one example that since the ALS last year, we've closed 547 transactions worth $14.2 billion. This is an increase of about 67% over the year before. And it really demonstrates how we've redoubled our efforts across the United States government to engage with Africa, to invest and to trade in a meaningful way.
When you talk about some of the contracts that have been closed, highlight some of those areas of investment.
Well, these areas of investment range the gamut of sectors, and this is because it's private sector driven. We have deals in energy, in aviation, in healthcare, in agriculture. We've incentivized over the last year or been part of $242 million of exports from the continent to the United States, helping to utilize the AGOA mechanism.
When I've talked to a lot of people on the continent, they seem to suggest that the U.S., despite these commitments, the U.S. is not doing enough. They need more dollars invested in Africa. How do you respond to those people in Africa who say, this is like a drop in the ocean?
Public sector resources, whether they're from any part of the globe, will have a limited impact because the investment needs on the continent are so great. In infrastructure alone, the African Development Bank estimates that $100 billion of investment is needed just to fill the infrastructure gap on a continual basis. What we focus on is stimulating the private sector. And sometimes you'll see the private sector doing something and you would not know that Prosper Africa, that the U.S. government is supporting that particular business. But we believe that the multiplier effect that we can achieve through stimulating and incentivizing private investment will have an even greater impact than anything that the public that will come from the public sector.
Are there some countries that have taken advantage of the opportunities that Prosper Africa offers in terms of investment and trade?
We've seen African countries, African companies, take an interest in investing and having a presence in the United States. We have banks like United Bank for Africa, Rand Merchant Bank, I understand, opened a branch in New York earlier this year. Investments that complement and seem to enlarge and provide opportunities for African businesses to do more trade or more investment or more financing activities. We've seen that sort of proliferate over the last decade or so.
That was Micah Jordan, the Chief of Staff of Prosper Africa, a U.S. government initiative to boost trade and investment on the continent. He was speaking with viewers, Paul Ndiom. The French news agency AFP says more than 110 elephants have died in the soaring heat in Zimbabwe's largest animal reserve, Hwange National Park, with dark clouds in recent days promising life-saving rains. The rangers may not find all of the victims of the drought on their daily treks. The 14,600 square kilometer or 5,600 square mile park is home to more than 45,000 savannah elephants, so many that they are considered a threat to the environment. A spokesperson for the Zimbabwe National Parks Authority, Zimparks, said the old, the young, and the sick have been worst hit. On average, an elephant drinks more than 200 liters of water and eats some 140 kilos of food a day. And now some holiday greetings from VOA listeners around the continent.
James Roy Majok from United States, Bentiu Town. I want to send my greeting to my mother, plus my friend who are listening on VO News programs. A special greeting goes to Peter Goj Anyang Majungdul in Bor, Jacob Dior Macheng in Europe. Final greeting goes to two journalists of VO News, Peter Colote and James Batty. Guys, thanks for good services that you always deliver it, and we will still continue with VOA News daily coverage news. It is a reliable radio that has good news, and I like to listen for it every day. Thanks, happy new year, happy Christmas, and happy new year.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, friends and fans of the VOA. I am Daniel Gino Pessima from Freetown, Sierra Leone, West Africa. I wish you all Merry Christmas. I thank you for accepting VOA, the Voice of America, as your number one station in the world and beyond. I thank you all. God bless you. I thank the staff, the general staff of the VOA. I even thanks all the journalists of the VOA, the reporters of the VOA, the questionnaires of the VOA. I thank you. I extend my Christmas greetings to you. Season greetings to all of you. Once again, I am Daniel Gino Pessima from Freetown, Sierra Leone, West.
Hey, Tom, Vincent McCorry. Of all the latest developments of the content 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Vandy, and our engineer, Audrius Regis, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.